I'm Roland Dye, been an active Palestine campaigner for the last 20 years after going over to the West Bank and making documentaries about the situation there. So I've been involved ever since, and I'm currently the secretary of the Bristol Palestine Solidarity Campaign, and that group, along with Stop the War, are now part of the newly formed Bristol Palestine Alliance, which are the people who organise the large demonstrations that we've seen every fortnight over the last couple of months here in Bristol.
Last time I spoke to you, you were up at Fas Lane.
Oh, that's going back a bit. That was the summer before last. Yes, a protest anti-nuclear campaign group. We drove up to Scotland and we were towing a giant peace logo on a trailer all the way to Scotland because it was the anniversary, 40 years, I think, of the Fas Lane peace camp up there. Brave people who have got a permanent site there opposite the Fas Lane submarine base. So we visited them. And we also went to Coalport, which is less well known, but highly important. That's where Britain stores the warheads, something over 200 nuclear warheads, which are loaded onto the missiles, which are loaded into the submarines that go into and fro the Trident system.
Obviously, the Scots don't really like this, but we have, in a way, an even more dangerous thing going on down in Plymouth, because you've got a nuclear dockyard there with stored former nuclear submarines that are still to be properly decommissioned, right next to a city of a quarter of a million people.
Yes, a wake-up call for people when talking about this sort of stuff is the question, how many nuclear-powered submarines has Britain ever decommissioned? Duh. And the answer is none. So everything from the 50s and 60s and 70s are piling up in Rosyth in Scotland and at Devonport down in Plymouth. So these hulks are there rusting away. The nuclear reactors are still in them. They have to be kept on cooling systems with a water system and electrical supply constantly circulating to keep them cool so they don't overheat and catch fire. And the reason that's been done is that the government's never had the money to build a special facility to take these things apart. So this legacy is piling up. People should be concerned. And also, this is a legacy for future generations who are going to sort out this mess. And it's dangerous while it's still going. Occasionally, the electricity gets switched off by accident. I'll leave you to draw your own conclusions of what would happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was around about 2002. We went down there and filmed a presentation by the nuclear engineer, John Large, explaining just how inadequate the risk models that were being used by the local authority, Plymouth City Council, were, and just how much the possibility there was of some sort of accident, which did include many of those quarter of a million people very, very close by, various things that could go wrong. But anyway, we're talking now about the crisis, if you can call it that, in Gaza, the massacre, I suppose. Day after day now, we're hearing of hundreds of people. This has not been on the news this morning, although what was on the news is the attacks by the Russians on Kiev, which didn't actually kill anybody, apparently, according to the news. So this seems to be almost being normalised by the news companies now. So it's almost, well, yeah, we expect that there are going to be a few hundred Palestinians a day killed in Gaza by the Israelis. So I know it was you had another get-together this week, didn't you, outside the council house, because the subject did come up at the full council meeting delayed from last month. They tried to cram two full council meetings in to one this month, didn't they?
Well, yes, certainly the council were having a very busy time forced on them by the Barton Hill problem. So two full council meetings running back to back. So Palestine campaigners were outside doing a stall and a rally from noon right through the afternoon. And several councillors came out to thank us for what we were doing and explaining that they were on side with us. We did the naming of the dead, which is always a very poignant process. And as you know, there was a 5,000 signature petition that's gone into the city council, pointing out that since Marvin had lit up the council house in the colours of the Israeli flag following the attack that happened to begin with, now considering the huge number of deaths in Gaza, wouldn't it be an equivalence to now light up the council house in the Palestine colours? Of course, Marvin or anybody else is not wanting to discuss this. So the evening, as the evening wore on, somebody appeared with a projector and a battery system and such like and did a projection of the Palestine flag and logo onto the outside of the council house. So well done to the people of Bristol. They have done what Marvin was refusing to do. So well done, Bristol, once again, doing the right thing, standing on the right side of history.
And there was also a resignation of one of his councillors, wasn't there? He's already in a rather fragile position with the Labour group now no longer the biggest group of councillors on there, but another one has resigned yesterday.
Yes, respect to former councillor Zoe Goodman. I've just watched the video this morning of her resignation, very dignified resignation speech in the council chamber. And she may not be the only one, because people are horrified. Good councillors who want to represent their community, they know people's concerns. The public can see via social media the genocide, the wanton genocide, which is currently happening in Gaza, amply supplied by America and by this country, which is flying weaponry via Cyprus to keep Israel supplied. So we've got a ringside seat of a ghastly genocide and backed by our political leaders. This is quite apocalyptic. And I personally feel we're seeing a breakdown of governance. The old democracy model that we vote for our MPs and then we lobby them and then they'll sort it all out. Now they're hiding. As my job as the secretary of Bristol Palestine Solidarity Campaign, every time there's one of these fortnightly marches and rallies on College Green, it's my job to email all four Labour councillor MPs in Bristol and of Marvin the Mayor, inviting them to come to the rally and speak to the people who are so concerned about what's happening in Gaza, or to send the message that we will read out. And of course, tragically, get no answer whatsoever.
Well, that is interesting, particularly, Roland, that is interesting, particularly because I can remember listening to Thangam Debonair. I think it was back in around about 2009 when she was campaigning to become the MP, being an absolute champion of the Palestinian cause. So why now is she looking the other way? She's a major spokesperson for the Labour Party under Keir Starmer now.
Yes, it's really shocking, isn't it? And the word disingenuous does spring to mind. I'll be polite on that. But it is shocking, and I'm sure people are going to shop elsewhere with their votes when the elections, national and local, come round.
Well, what do you make of this? Because the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn was actually pro-Palestinian. He was called a terrorist for supporting Hamas, although, of course, Hamas is a legitimate group representing the Palestinians. There is a great deal of question over whether it's realistic to call them terrorists. Although, of course, the tactics used by the Israelis are terrorists. But what do you put this change in the Labour Party, complete swing from one side to the other in this conflict? What do you put it down to?
Well, I joined the Labour Party when Corbyn was the leader for all those reasons and more. But unfortunately, the deep state here in Britain decides that it's in alliance with America. We've seen this ever since the war in Iraq. We were the junior partner to discover America. They weren't doing it all alone. They could claim that they had a coalition. And the deep state isn't going to tolerate anybody who rocks the boat on that. They're supporting Israel to the hilt, which are their primary military force in the Middle East. We're seeing not the number one oil supplier for the planet, but amongst the major oil suppliers for the planet. That's why it's so crucially important. And British foreign policy has to fall in line with that. But after all, what's new? We are a former colonial power, conquered a quarter of the planet. They didn't go around by being nice to people. You know, Britain and other European powers gained their colonies by genocide and intimidation. And I was doing a workshop recently, reading out some articles from The Guardian, just about the horrendous brutality that the British meted out to people in the concentration camps in Kenya as recently as the 1950s. That's within my lifetime. And we only know about that because they made a mistake and they forgot to destroy official records. So, of course, this was happening everywhere. And we have a brutal history. And unfortunately, the current regime looks like they're hell-bent on continuing that. It's a bad world, but now people's eyes are perhaps opening. And we have to somehow bring about a better world ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder, because, I mean, we've got general election and local elections in May here next year, Roland. I mean, it certainly looks as if the tide is drifting away from Labour because of their, not just because of their support for Keir Starmer, who's very unpopular, but also on this particular issue, it may even lead to Thangam Debonair losing her seat to a Green, possibly. And certainly it looks as if the Greens are going to be the largest party at Bristol City Council because of this issue.
That's how it's looking to me as well. I mean, the Greens are the only major political party who are calling for a ceasefire, so respect to them. And they're going to sweep up as a result of that. You know, it's nice to see somebody having some principle and some spine amongst our political leaders.
So anyway, one of the other reasons I wanted to talk to you is because we had an interview with Dr. Chris Busby a couple of weeks ago about the appearance, mysterious appearance of enriched uranium in Gaza on the ground through soil samples. And published in 2021 in Nature magazine in a peer-reviewed paper. And it's not just this one paper. There are several that detail this appearance of enriched uranium scattered across Gaza. Now, this is something which is now obviously very difficult, if not impossible, to get in and do any further checks. But the thing is, the papers are sitting there, and the question is, where could this enriched uranium have come from? Sorry, but you've also got a background in physics, haven't you?
Well, I've got PhD in nuclear physics, but I was particularly focusing on medical uses, so avoided weaponry. But I've got a basic understanding, and I was doing a bit of reading just before the interview. So Wikipedia gives quite a succinct summary, of course, that a neutron bomb was a design from, in fact, as far back as the 1950s or 60s. The idea is that it would be a reduced blast but enhanced radiation, which would then be effective at sort of mass armored columns, the so-called Soviet, you know, tank invasions of Western Europe that we were being made to be scared of at the time, and fortifications and bunkers and such like. So it's a relatively small device, but would produce a lot of radiation, which would be lethal to human beings. So the radiation would reach out on a much larger area than the original explosion. It's very complicated. I mean, those soil samples, which were gathered some years ago, are obviously very precious and carry a signature and a witness of what's going on. It's probably hard to actually unravel it all. But on a broader front, Israel makes a fortune from testing novel munitions, and it uses Gaza as a test laboratory. They spend 5% of their GDP on the military, which is actually a bigger proportion than, say, this country or the United States. And they have a multi-billion pound weapons industry, and they're able to sell their weaponry because they're battle tested.
Well, can you give us an example of the sort of things that they're testing there?
Well, crowd control, sublethal munitions such as rubber bullets and sponge bullets, skunk water, which is sprayed around liberally in the West Bank when they want to disperse crowds. You've got the whole IT sector, which is, you know, crunching all that data to run the checkpoints and facial recognition. And then you've got the actual lethal weaponry, which is being, well, the surveillance drones over Gaza, microwave beams, whatever it is that they're cooking up, they've got a test laboratory. I remember some years ago, I think it must have been after the 2014 attack, I attended a lecture by a group of medics, and they were showing slides of the injuries which were being seen by the doctors in Gaza, or indeed some of them might have been actually going over and volunteering their services. I mean, these were pretty gruesome, awful imageries. But, of course, it's what the medics are confronting on a daily basis. And they were pointing out that some of the wounds, people's arms sort of seared off, or the sort of injuries to their skin and such like, were not normal munitions. This wasn't the normal shrapnel from bomb fragments or bullets or whatever. They were talking about tungsten dust, shrapnel made of small cubes of tungsten, which is a much heavier metal, or heat blast weaponry. These were awful wounds, but they're very characteristic. People are probably familiar with the interviews with medics in Gaza at the moment, who say they can recognize the wounds from the white phosphorus, which is being sprayed over Gaza. And I saw today in southern Lebanon as well. So these are tiny particles of phosphorus, which continue to burn even when they hit the skin, and they will burn down through the tissue and down to the bones. And when exposed to the air, they will reignite and start to burn again, which leave terrible and very hard to treat injuries on the people affected on a mass scale. So it's truly ghastly what's going on in Gaza. It's not a war. It's a genocide and a golden opportunity for Israel to test any new munitions that it might have in the pipeline. So I wouldn't rule anything out, and it just shows the awfulness of the situation going on.
I mean, surely if weapons of mass destruction were being used, it would be news all over the world.
Well, going back to the neutron bombs, these would be relatively small. I mean, I think I was reading something from Chris Busby. These could be as small as a tennis ball or the actual active parts. And we've seen the colossal explosions that are stuff that's being dropped on Gaza. You know, the rockets, the bombs, the artillery shells being used to just destroy the infrastructure on a mass scale. I mean, it does look like they're trying to make Gaza totally uninhabitable. I mean, even the university, I was told that not only did they shell it or bomb it, but then they put demolition explosives to wreck the building. So this is all part of a scorched earth policy to make Gaza uninhabitable. It is so shocking. It is so shocking. This isn't a war. This is a genocide.
And so what do you think the international community can do? I mean, they've tried several votes now at the United Nations Security Council. Although the General Assembly is behind it, the Americans at the Security Council keep using their veto and the British abstain.
Well, I suppose they get together and they decide who's going to veto it. America decides to do that, and everybody else can just hold their hands up and say it wasn't us. But it is so shocking. I'll say again, we're witnessing a genocide, a slaughter, a terrible havoc being wreaked on largely innocent people, good people, and anybody who's had contact with Palestinians, it's so good-hearted. I'm remembering my visits to the West Bank. And it breaks our heart, and that's why people are so upset. That's why the demonstrations have been so big everywhere around the country, including here in Bristol.
So are you saying that the Israelis don't have a right to self-defence?
Well, according to international law, it isn't self-defence because they are the occupying power. So I'm very glad to be able to clear that conundrum up, because that's so widely bandied around in the media, and it's obviously there to be deliberately misleading.
If people are interested in following what the Palestine Solidarity Campaign nationally and in Bristol is up to, what's the best way to do that?
Bristol Palestine Solidarity Campaign has Facebook and Instagram, so check those out. and then the newly formed Bristol Palestine Alliance, ditto, and we're just building up the website at the moment. So lots of ways to get in contact and lots of ways to get involved. And the learning process and the involvement and the good-heartedness of everybody working together in teams is our hope for the future. So Palestine unites us, as the chant goes.
Okay, Roland Dye, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much.